The man who shot Brian Thompson walked past the Hotel Hilton Midtown security camera at 6:44 in the morning. He wore a tan jacket and a dark mask. He had a backpack on. He walked with purpose, but without urgency. The deliberate pace of someone who knows exactly where he is going and does not want to appear to know. The security footage would later be studied in forensic detail by investigators and journalists, and millions of people who watched it on their phones. This figure moving through the gray Manhattan morning with the particular confidence of someone who has decided, Brian Thompson, the CEO of United Healthcare, was standing outside the hotel, waiting for the annual investor conference to begin. At approximately 6:46 a.m. on December 4, 2024, he was shot twice, once in the back, once in the calf. He collapsed on the sidewalk of West 54th Street. Bystanders rushed to help. Thompson was transported to a hospital, where he was pronounced dead. The killer had already left on foot, moving north toward Central Park. What followed over the next 5 days was one of the most intensive manhunts in recent New York history, and one of the most watched true crime events in American public life since the trial of O.J. Simpson. The case would raise questions, not just about who had committed the murder, but why. And why the answer to that second question had ignited a public reaction that no law enforcement agency, no media institution, and no corporate communications department had been prepared for. Brian Thompson was 50 years old when he died. He had led United Healthcare, the nation's largest private health insurer, since 2021. Under his tenure, the company had been the subject of multiple investigations and class action lawsuits related to its claims, denial rates, the percentage of medical claims it rejected, at a rate that independent analyses found among the highest in the industry. Thompson was, by all available accounts, a competent and respected executive within his industry. He was not known publicly. He was not a celebrity CEO. He was the kind of man who ran a company that most Americans interacted with through their insurance cards and their explanation of benefits letters. And, more frequently than they hoped, through the word denied. He had a wife and 2 sons. He coached youth football. He lived in Minnesota. The shooter left 3 spent shell casings on the sidewalk of 54th Street. Investigators found, inscribed on the casings, the words deny, defend, and depose. These words did not become public immediately. When they did, they were understood immediately by anyone familiar with the insurance industry criticism that had been building for years. They were a reference to a claims handling strategy, documented by a Rutgers University law professor in a book called Delay, Deny, Defend, a description of how insurance companies systematically avoided paying claims. Whether the shooter intended a direct reference to that specific work or to the broader critique it represented, the message was unmistakably intentional. The investigation moved quickly in some dimensions and slowly in others. The ghost gun, a privately assembled, untraceable firearm with a suppressor, was recovered in Central Park. The backpack the shooter had worn was found in a hostel. Inside the backpack were protein bars, a water bottle, and a handwritten notebook. The full contents of that notebook have never been made public by prosecutors. Multiple news organizations filed legal challenges to obtain access to the notebook, and those challenges were pending as of the April 2026 trial proceedings. What was confirmed from the notebook? It contained writings that investigators characterized as expressing grievances about the American healthcare system. Specific phrases referenced in court documents described health insurance companies in terms that prosecutors characterized as expressing homicidal intent. Defense attorneys characterized the same writings as the expression of a political philosophy, not a murder plan. Luigi Mangione was 26 years old when he was arrested on December 9, 2024, at a McDonald's in Altona, Pennsylvania. He had been identified from surveillance footage, first by facial recognition analysis, and then through a tip from a McDonald's employee who recognized him from news coverage. He was a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, where he had studied computer science with distinction, graduating valedictorian. His family ran a successful real estate business in Maryland. By every external measure, He was a young man who had successfully navigated every system the American establishment had placed in front of him. He had a Glock 17 ghost gun when he was arrested. He had a suppressor. He had additional ammunition. He had a forged New Jersey identification. He had notes that investigators would describe to the press in general terms, writings that referenced economic inequality, corporate power, and the American healthcare system. The specific content of those notes has remained, like the notebook, subject to ongoing legal dispute over what may be presented at trial. The public reaction to the arrest was unlike anything that had followed a murder arrest in recent American memory. On social media platforms, Mangione became, within hours of his arrest, a figure around whom profound ambivalence had crystallized. The reaction was not universal, and it was not simple. Many people expressed horror at the murder of a man who had a family, who had done nothing individually that day that warranted being shot on a public sidewalk. Many people expressed simultaneous sympathy with the stated frustrations about the healthcare system that the shooter appeared to have held. The coexistence of these responses, grief and identification, condemnation and comprehension, produced a public conversation that was uncomfortable for almost everyone involved in having it. Law enforcement officials emphasized, correctly and necessarily, that whatever the alleged motive, the murder of a private citizen is a criminal act subject to the full weight of American law. Mental health advocates noted that Mangione had disclosed in online posts reviewed after his arrest that he had suffered from serious chronic back pain following a spinal fusion surgery in 2023, a procedure he had traveled to Mexico to undergo, reportedly after struggling with the financial dimensions of domestic healthcare access. Defense attorneys would later argue that his physical suffering had profoundly affected his mental state. Prosecutors would argue that the planning evident in the crime, the ghost gun, the suppressor, the forged ID, the pre-scouted location, the five-day evasion, demonstrated a level of deliberate calculation inconsistent with any claim of diminished capacity. He had crossed state lines. He had researched Thompson specifically. There were digital footprints, searches, location data, traces of the kind that modern devices leave in the record, whether their users intend to or not, that placed him in New York in the days before the shooting. The investigation had produced, by the time of his arrest, a forensic reconstruction of his movements that was substantial. The case against him, in purely evidentiary terms, was not ambiguous. What remained ambiguous, what the trial of April 2026 was, in its deepest registers about, was what his act meant, not legally. Legally, the question of meaning was irrelevant to guilt, but culturally, politically, in the space where law and public consciousness intersect in a democracy, the meaning question could not be suppressed. Why had so many people felt something complicated when they read the word denied scratched into a shell casing on a Manhattan sidewalk? What did that complication say about the relationship between a population and the systems that govern some of the most consequential aspects of their lives? These questions do not have answers that the legal system can provide. Mangione faced charges in both New York State and federal court. The federal charges carried the possibility of the death penalty. The killing of a corporate executive with evidence of interstate planning triggered federal jurisdiction under statutes that had rarely been applied in cases of this kind. The decision to pursue the death penalty at the federal level had itself become a subject of political dispute. New York State does not have the death penalty. The federal choice to pursue it was characterized by supporters as appropriate, given the severity and premeditation of the crime. It was characterized by critics as a prosecutorial escalation driven by the identity of the victim rather than the requirements of justice. The notebook in the backpack, this is the thing that would not go away. Multiple sources with knowledge of the investigation had confirmed in background conversations with journalists that the notebook contained substantial written material. Some accounts characterized it as a manifesto of sorts, a document in which Mangione had described his worldview, his grievances, and his conclusions. Other accounts were more cautious, noting that the legal definition of manifesto carries implications of a certain kind of political violence that prosecutors were careful to handle within the constraints of admissible evidence. What was not in dispute? The notebook existed. It was in investigators' possession. Its contents had influenced the framing of the case, and the public had not been allowed to read it. The argument for sealing the notebook, or for restricting its public release, was legally conventional. That publishing its contents before trial could prejudice jury selection, inflame public opinion in ways that made a fair trial impossible, or, in more muted versions of the argument, provide a platform for the articulation of views that could inspire further violence. The argument against sealing it was equally conventional and equally forceful. That in a society that claimed to value transparency in its legal proceedings, withholding significant evidence from public view, evidence that bore directly on the most publicly significant murder case in recent years, raised questions about what the legal system was protecting and whom. Luigi Mangione sat at the defense table in April 2026, looking, by all accounts from those present, composed. His attorneys had filed motions challenging the death penalty consideration on constitutional grounds, motions challenging the admissibility of several pieces of evidence, and motions related to the notebook. He had not, as of the beginning of trial proceedings, entered any guilty plea. He had maintained a consistent silence in public. He had not given interviews. He had not issued statements. The notebook, whatever was in it, had not spoken in his voice in any public forum. Brian Thompson's family had sat through hearings and pre-trial proceedings with the particular silence of people who have been told by their attorneys that the time for speaking is not now. His wife made a brief public statement in the months following his death that emphasized his humanity, his role as a father, and her family's suffering. She did not address the public reaction to his murder. The jury was being selected. The evidence was being prepared. The notebook was sealed. What was inscribed on those shell casings, deny, defend, depose, was a message written in the grammar of extreme action, but in the vocabulary of a political argument that millions of Americans had been having in less violent idioms for years. What the trial could not do, for all of its procedural gravity, was adjudicate that argument. That argument was happening elsewhere, in congressional hearings about healthcare reform, in the comment sections of news articles about claim denial rates, in emergency rooms and pharmacy lines and insurance appeal processes, where ordinary people had been navigating the word denied for their entire adult lives. Luigi Mangione would be judged by a jury of his peers. The peers were Americans. Whether they were his peers in any deeper sense than the legal one was the question that the notebook, still sealed, still unread by the public, might one day answer or refuse to. The digital archaeology of Luigi Mangione's online presence, conducted by journalists, true crime researchers, and investigators in the weeks following his arrest, produced a portrait that resisted simple categorization. He had been active on social media platforms in ways that were unremarkable for his demographic and generation. Fitness content, book recommendations, political commentary that was engaged but not extremist by any standard metric. He had recommended, in posts that were archived before his account was taken down, books that ranged from works on economics to philosophy to health and wellness. He had, in these posts, expressed admiration for writers and thinkers whose work engaged with questions of systemic inequality and corporate power. None of these interests were unusual. None of them, individually or in combination, would have placed him on any law enforcement radar. His back injury was a point of particular attention in the months following the arrest. Friends and former acquaintances who spoke to reporters described a man who had been, before the surgery, physically active to a degree that was central to his identity. Surfing, fitness, outdoor activities that had formed a significant part of how he navigated the world. The fusion surgery in 2023 had been, by his own subsequent account in the online posts, only partially successful in resolving his pain. Chronic pain patients, medical professionals who treat them, and pain advocacy organizations all pointed, carefully and without any desire to be seen as justifying the murder, to the well-documented relationship between severe chronic pain and the kind of psychological desperation that healthy people find difficult to fully comprehend. None of this served as a legal defense. It was not intended to. It was, rather, the human texture of the story. The thing that turned a true crime case into something that felt, uncomfortably, like a mirror. The defense team was distinguished. Mangione had retained attorneys with significant trial experience in high-profile federal cases, and the legal strategy that began to emerge in the pre-trial period was sophisticated. The constitutional challenges to the death penalty were built on arguments that had been advancing, in various forms, through multiple federal circuits for years. The evidentiary challenges were specific and targeted. The central strategic question, whether to argue diminished capacity, political motivation, or some combination of both, remained, as of the beginning of trial, the subject of intense legal debate behind closed doors. The federal prosecutor's opening had been, according to observers in the courtroom, crisp and methodical. A timeline from the first confirmed sighting of Mangione in New York to the moment of arrest in Pennsylvania, supported by surveillance footage, cell tower data, forensic ballistics, and the physical evidence recovered at multiple points along the route. The murder was, the prosecutor told the jury, not complicated. A man had planned to kill another man. He had prepared extensively. He had traveled across state lines. He had acquired weapons specifically designed to avoid identification. He had waited, outside the hotel, for his target to appear. And when his target appeared, he had shot him in the back. The defense did not contest the sequence of events as presented. What the defense contested was what the events meant, and whether the federal government's decision to pursue the death penalty was constitutionally and morally proportionate to the facts as established. The trial was, as of late April 2026, in its second week. No verdict had been reached. The notebook had not been entered into evidence in any publicly accessible form. The question of what was in it, what Mangione had written in that precise handwriting, in that backpack, during whatever journey had brought him to a Manhattan sidewalk on a December morning, remained the great unsettled fact at the center of a case that had already refused, from the beginning, to be simple. Expansion, expansion, expansion. Becco's story, expansion. Becco's story, /TMP/Mangione.